Chapter 19. Underway with Forged Papers. On a Saturday evening in late February or early March of 1943, I said goodbye to my three friends, left the house, and drove to Volensky railway station in Warsaw, wearing the same clothes in which I had arrived. A Jewish armband was sewn into my jacket, since I would need it to enter the ghetto. My Polish companion met me in front of the station. Again, the military and civilian agents were looking for Jews. They were everywhere. Once more I felt their attention directed towards me. Those parasites lived off our blood. Because the Germans were hardly able to recognize Jews shaved and in modern dress, denunciation and extortion were mostly Polish specialties. Hence we feared these Polish accusers more than anyone else. But again I was lucky and got through. The train started. This time, too, I felt no fear. The excitement helped me as a good medicine would. My spirits were raised. The weeks of hiding and endless waiting in fear and uncertainty, without being able to do anything, had crushed me psychologically. Now I was finally back in action. I felt that my destiny was in my own hands, and I was betting everything I had against the Nazis. I almost felt like a hero. On the other hand, I tried to count the number of death penalties I had earned that day. The fingers of both my hands were not enough. My companion and I were sitting in an open compartment, separated from each other. I had a small suitcase containing shirts, socks, etc., which was guaranteed to be kosher. My companion had an old, unobtrusive-looking bag, which was completely treif. This bag contained 60 blank identification cards, as well as 60 work permits and birth certificates, the necessary stamps, staples, ink, and 4 other ID cards, with pictures, signatures, and accompanying documents. The 4 sets of documents which were already completed were for 4 friends in Suchowola, Edel Turkeltaub, Edessa Turkeltaub, and possibly the Gellermans' parents, who still were hiding somewhere near Suchowola. Moshka told me about the 4 extra identification cards only moments before our departure. Those concerned were to contact me in order to pick up their papers. I was also to prepare and deliver an identification card for Eva Zito. Eva was a very pretty girl and a friend from school. She could sing beautifully and all the boys were in love with her. In the end, she had worked at the Arbeitsamt, labor office, and belonged to the half-privileged. When I arrived in the ghetto, I discovered that she had been shot the day before, because an Aryan identification card from another source had been found in her possession. At about 2 a.m. we arrived in Mijajek. In the station once more there was a line of gendarmes, Polish police, and secret agents intensely searching for Jews. We managed to get through and went to a nearby hotel. My behavior was self-confident. Why and for what reason, I do not know. Perhaps it was because of my elegant clothes, the boots, or the beautiful feather in my hat. I presented a large banknote with my false identification card, and was given a bed, as was my companion. I asked to be awakened at 6:15 a.m., emphasizing that I would be picked up at that time by a horse wagon from a neighboring farm, where I was working as an agriculturalist. Should the wagon arrive earlier, then I was to be roused immediately. We were lodged in a room filled with beds in which mostly Wehrmacht soldiers were sleeping. We lay down, but I did not close my eyes throughout the entire night. Shortly before 6 o'clock, I left the hotel, sneaked quickly to the ghetto fence, and within an instant found myself inside. My Polish companion, who remained in the hotel, and I had arranged a meeting at 7:25 that same morning at a designated spot along the ghetto fence. He was to bring me the bag with the vital contents at that time. If for some reason things did not work out, then a meeting at the same time and place was arranged for the next day. If we did not meet by the third day, then we would know that something extraordinary had happened. Wearing my armband, I walked through the ghetto and found the house where my cousin Leo and other relatives were living. There I left my hat, which was not suitable ghetto attire, and could have attracted attention. I then hurried back to the prearranged place along the fence in order to receive the bag, but my companion was nowhere to be seen. Feeling that I had almost reached my goal, the anxious minutes of waiting seemed an eternity. The situation was not without danger, since loitering near the fence was forbidden. Instead of my friend, a Gestapo official suddenly appeared. I knew him from Rajin, and he was now in charge of this ghetto. He shouted, "Hey, Jew, stop! What are you doing here, near the fence?" Spontaneously, I told him I was supposed to work with a roofer and was waiting for him. Out of the corner of my eye, I spied a gate and a sign with the word roofer. He slapped my face twice, nearly turning me around, calling me a pig Jew, grabbed his pistol, and ordered, "Hands up." I stood in front of him with my hands raised. He searched me from head to foot, opened my winter coat and my jacket, turned every pocket inside out, including the small watch pocket, and inspected every piece of paper he found. Fortunately, he forgot my back pants pocket. In that one I had the forged Aryan identification card, work permit, and birth certificate in the name of Jan Wozniak. Again he insulted me with pig Jew, and gave me a kick in the pants to speed my disappearance. In my relief I hardly felt his kick, and I vanished immediately. I regarded this event as a miracle, and saw it as an omen that I had a real chance of surviving, and that I would make it. I am usually not superstitious, but at that particular moment I was glad that I was. If the Gestapo official had searched my back pocket and found my forged papers, he would either have shot me on the spot or taken me with him for interrogation, but I was still alive and felt even more encouraged. The following morning I hurried to the fence again, but I was a few minutes late because a rude Jewish policeman had caught me and wanted to take me to work. I pleaded with him, but he would not release me until finally I found a chance to escape. Out of breath, I arrived at the fence, but again my Polish escort was not there. I panicked, thinking that something unforeseen must have happened. As it was getting dark, I sneaked out of the ghetto with neither papers or armband, which was punishable by death. I walked down all the streets near the hotel where we stayed, but could not see my friend anywhere. On the next morning, I was at the fence before the prearranged time, this time outside the ghetto. Again, he did not show up. I sensed trouble. Something must have gone wrong. Now I was entirely on my own. We had planned to stay 4 to 6 days in the Mijijek ghetto. Then we wanted to return to my first hideout, the farm at Pludi, which was about 20 kilometers from Mijijek, and from there return to Warsaw. For that reason, I had little money and only the most necessary clothing. We had only reckoned on two possibilities. Either I'd be caught while traveling, or the mission would be successful, and the papers would reach the ghetto. If I was arrested and tortured, there was not much I could tell the Nazis, since I was not given any sensitive information before my departure. We had not even considered the third possibility, that after a successful journey, I could lose contact with my companion. In such situations, one cannot consider all the possible difficulties, otherwise one would not undertake any such endeavor. After 3 days, 3 nights, and numerous stops at the fence outside the ghetto, I was unable to re-establish contact with my escort. I then realized that I was in an extraordinarily difficult situation. I felt that I was losing the ground under my feet from 1 minute to the next. With my cousin, Leo Szupak, I found a place to stay inside the ghetto. He was sharing his one-room apartment with his wife, his two children, and my relative, Miriam Blumenkopf, with her two children. Miriam's husband had been a goldsmith and jeweler. He was wealthy and had worked for the Gestapo in his profession. When he saw the end approaching, he hid at a farm in a village. When his situation there became hopeless, he committed suicide by cutting his throat with a razor. There was nothing left for Miriam to do except return to the ghetto of Mijijek with no money and with her two children, a 12-year-old girl and a younger son. Her daughter, Fradl, became the breadwinner of the family. She sold and distributed bread, which she received through connections from the well-known baker Leibisch. One day the girl caught a cold and developed pneumonia. Since there were no medical facilities in the ghetto, she died soon thereafter. Two brothers lived in the same room with Leo, who had been brought there from Parchev, a nearby town. They were about my age, but I had not known them before. Also, two or three Jews from Biala Podlaska were living with my cousin. One of them, Shepsel Rosen, the only one whose name I remember, was a quiet, well-educated man. On New Year's Eve, 1943, he and 50 other Jews were caught by the Gestapo and driven to a manure storage area on the edge of the Mijijek ghetto. In celebration of the New Year, the drunken SS men shot them. They then ordered the Judenrat to remove the bodies. The Jewish police found Shepsel alive with several bullet wounds in his backside. Thus he was saved, temporarily. He originally came from Biala Podlaska, where, as far as I know, the Nazis committed their first big crime in the winter of 1939-40. They drove hundreds of Jewish prisoners of war and of the Polish army of Jewish origin on foot from Podziep Lwatow to Biala Podlaska, where their death march ended in a mass execution. In each town they passed through, several hundred Jewish prisoners were shot and buried in mass graves. 12 people were already living in this small one-room apartment when I arrived. I was the 13th. Mrs. Grunberg was the owner of the entire apartment. She had a separate room which she shared with her daughter and her 12-year-old son. Her daughter and my cousin, Meir Turkeltaub, disappeared one day before an action and found shelter on a farm. Later in the 70s, they both died in Israel. Only my cousin Leo knew the secret of my journey. On his advice, we hid my Aryan papers in the attic. Thus, I became a nameless Jew again, on his way to the Endlösung. It was understandable that I was not particularly welcome in my cousin's apartment. After all, I represented a certain danger for everyone, and I also needed food and a place to sleep, even though both of these commodities were scarce. Hence, I usually left the apartment before my cousins started to eat their small meals, and returned when I was sure that they had finished. I appreciated the fact that Leo and the others always invited me to eat with them. I usually refused out of a sense of pride. They soon realized, however, that my claims that I had already eaten were lies. Sometimes I did not eat for days, but my real anguish was the separation from my chevra, which had become my second family, and my abortive mission. Some of my friends and acquaintances from Radzin were living in the ghetto of Mierzetz at that time. They knew about me and the chevra. After seeing me in the ghetto in my miserable condition, they lost all respect for me. This was no time for sensitivity. Victors make history, but I was on the side of the losers.